Welcome, everyone. We're glad that you're joining us today. I'm Karen Shapiro, Vice President of Partners for Progressive Israel. Welcome. Before I hand it over to today's discussion moderator, let me note that Partners for Progressive Israel is an American not-for-profit organization dedicated to the achievement of a durable and just peace between Israel and its neighbors, which must include the end of the occupation for the Palestinian people, and believes in the need to ensure civil rights, equality, and social justice for all of Israel's inhabitants. We seek to deepen the understanding of the complexities of both Israeli and Palestinian societies to create better advocates for a progressive Israel future. We are glad to be bringing this webinar to all of you here today for free. If you like it and want more programming like this, please visit at progressiveisrael.org and make a contribution on our website. Now let me introduce our moderator for today, Jared Jackson. Jared is the founder and executive director of Jews in All Hues, an education and advocacy organization that builds a world where intersectional diversity and dignity are normative. A Philadelphia-born multi-heritage Jew, Jared is an internationally renowned Jewish diversity leader, consultant, facilitator, speaker, writer, musician, and entrepreneur. He is an alum of the Sela Leadership Program through Bend the Arc, a Jewish partnership for justice. Jared holds a certificate of nonprofit management from LaSalle University and was named one of the Jews that will change the world by the periodical Ma'ariv. Along with everything else, Jared is scheduled to graduate from Hebrew Union College with a Master of Arts in Jewish Nonprofit Management in May of 2021. Take it away, Jared.
Thank you, Karen. I would like to introduce our panelists. First up is Rabbi Jill Jacobs. She's the executive director of TRUA, the Rabbinic Call for Human Rights, an organization that trains and mobilizes more than 2,000 rabbis and cantors and their communities to bring a moral voice to protecting and advancing human rights in North America, Israel, and the occupied Palestinian territories. Our next panelist is Kenneth S. Stern. He is the director of the Bard Center for the Study of Hate, an attorney and award-winning author. For 25 years, he served as the American Jewish Committee's expert on anti-Semitism. Recently, he was nominated for the National Book Award for his latest book, The Conflict Over the Conflict: The Israel-Palestine Campus Debate. Thank you both for joining us today. So I just want to start out with a very straightforward question. As fast as possible, what is anti-Semitism?
I can do it very briefly. I mean, the core of anti-Semitism to me is its conspiracy theory about Jews. It's that Jews conspired to harm non-Jews, and it also gives an explanation for what goes wrong in the world. That's the two components that are the nutshell. The rest, there are a lot more details that one could describe about how it works, but that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I also describe it as a giant conspiracy theory. And the other thing that I would add is that anti-Semitism has evolved in many ways throughout the years, but one of the main ways that it's evolved is that it started out as being about based in religion. So the Christian need to say that there was something to explain why Jews were still around even after Christianity had superseded Judaism, right? So this hatred of Jews that's based in religion, which then much later on in the 19th century morphed into something that was based in race. The idea that even if Jews converted, you know, even if Jews assimilated or went as far as converting into German society, they would then become an even more nefarious force trying to undermine the society from within, because you couldn't even tell that they were Jews. And that idea is certainly still around today.
Great. So what are some misconceptions around what anti-Semitism actually is?
Well, I'll start with a couple of misconceptions. There are so many, but one that relates to what I just said, that sometimes people think that it's just about religion, or that it's just about really just trying to wedge it into one particular area. It just happens on the left. It just happens on the right. It just is manifest in this way or that way. It's just about when there's actual violence, right? There's a lot of ways that that people think that anti-Semitism only fits into one category, but it's often broader. And the other thing that makes anti-Semitism sometimes harder to understand than other biases is that it's hard to count, right? So if you wanna look at racism in America, there are some numbers you can look at, right? You can say, well, how many people of color are in prison? How many people of color are in universities, right? Or women, like how many women are CEOs of, you know, Fortune 500 companies, et cetera. You can count certain things. But anti-Semitism, you can't necessarily, I mean, of course, there have been many, you know, throughout a lot of history, Jews were not allowed into certain professions or allowed to live in certain places. And that was even true in America until just a few decades ago. But now, at least in America, that's not the case. And anti-Semitism is still there. And in fact, sometimes thrives in being able to see Jews in prominent positions. And that's also why, you know, it's easy to say, well, there's no anti-Semitism because look how many Jews are, you know, graduate from university, but that's just not what it's actually about.
Yeah, and I'd agree with all that, but I'd also add another component, is that people tend to think of anti-Semitism as somehow siloed, that it's not related to the human capacity to see an us and a them and promote hatred based on that definition and vilification and demonization. So to give an example, I think everybody would see, you know, the Tree of Life synagogue attack is an event that should be counted as an anti-Semitic event. Nobody I know would think of the El Paso shooting to be considered in the same context. But if you look at the ideology of the two shooters, they were pretty much identical. They were worried about, as white Americans, we're going to be subsumed by these, you know, people of darker skin. There is someone going to come from our borders on the south. And, you know, one decided, well, it's the Jews that are making this happen. We're going to go shoot the Jews. The other is, I'm just going to go directly for the people that I'm worried about. Same ideology, but one, we, you know, is our lens of anti-Semitism and one isn't. So I think it's really critically important to think of anti-Semitism as a subset of the human capacity to hate. It has its unique characteristics, but it's not as if this is, you know, hatred of Jews is the only hatred that exists in the world, and to look at it outside of it is a mistake.
Thank you both. I just want to take this time to tell people, please don't wait to write any questions. Please start now if you have any questions for our panelists. We will have a shorter amount of time to actually get to your question. So please get on that. So my next question is, you know, Jill, you mentioned that there people are saying that there's anti-Semitism solely on the left and solely on the right. I'd like you to answer, how does it manifest when we're talking about political streams or whether we're talking about ideologies? Whether it's right wing or left wing.
Sure. So first of all, like, I mean, just to go back to what I started with that and what you referenced, that people try to often look at anti-Semitism only on the other side or think it can only manifest in one way. And very often I like to take another example, right? So if you think about sexism, it's not really surprising to anybody that there's sexism across the board, regardless of what political positions you might take, because it's in society, it's there. But for some reason, sometimes anti-Semitism, people assume that it's only gonna be on the other political side, but it's not, because it's a prejudice, it's just out there. We know that every prejudice also exists on the right and the left. You know, sometimes there's different manifestations about who tries to then codify it into law. So we can also talk about that, but certainly those prejudices are out there. So in general, this is in very broad strokes, but in general, I'm just going to talk about the US because that's where I live and work, and it might show up differently in other places, but at least in the United States, on the right, it tends to show up in the context of white nationalism. So ideas like Ken just said of the idea that the Jews are behind any kinds of movements that are trying to make America not a white Christian society. So the Jews will not replace us, which is not just about Jews somehow taking over, which is extremely unlikely given our numbers in the United States, but this conspiracy theory that actually Jews are behind, we're behind the civil rights movement, and that Jews are behind any movement to support refugees and immigrants. We saw that, of course, in Pittsburgh, and this idea that it was the Jews who were behind a conspiracy to bring brown refugees into the United States, and that's why that terrorist attacked a synagogue. So that's how it often shows up in that kind of a conspiracy theory. And on the left, we're gonna get, I'm sure, deep into this. So I just wanna just, this is just a very broad strokes, but on the left, it often shows up with the idea being that the hand of Israel is behind everything that's happening. So if the core of anti-Semitism is about Jews being a secret, nefarious, elders of Zion kind of force that is quietly pulling the strings, we see that show up around Israel or Zionism. And I just wanna be, I know we'll get into this much more in depth, but I'll just say it to start. That doesn't mean the criticism of Israel or even necessarily defining oneself as anti-Zionist is anti-Semitic, but that is the arena in which it shows up. And like I said, I'm sure we'll get to the details are more complicated, so I'm sure we'll get to the details later.
Yeah, and to add to that, I mean, one of the things I started with my book is some of my experiences in the early 80s when I was living in Portland, Oregon, and saw people of the far right, you know, precursors of the militia movement, people who studied this stuff, we remember the Posse Comitatus handing out anti-Semitic literature outside the courthouse. But then I was at protests against the Lebanon War in 82 and started seeing from some of my progressive colleagues, not, you know, criticism of what Israel was doing, which I agreed with their criticism, but the manner in which they were doing it and recycling some of the same tropes about Jewish control of the media, Jewish control of banks, and so forth. So, you know, some of the same sort of conspiratorial storylines go on the right and the left. And I fully agree with Jill. I mean, there's a when you look at how people form their boxes of how they view the world, and if Israel becomes a major concern for them on the right or in the left, and here particularly in the Jewish community, they try to create simplicity. They try to create black and white. So what happens is they try to, anything that may be a different position about Israel that may be somehow tinged with anti-Semitism, they'll explain it away. So the ZOA will invite Steve Bannon and vet him because he's a friend of Israel. And you see some of the same thing on the left too, people that would make critical comments about things that have been said that could have come out of the mouth of a Pat Buchanan but came out of somebody who's more progressive will sometimes get a little bit of a free ride. So to me, you know, the challenge here is to have a consistent principle and to be as concerned about anti-Semitism from whatever source. And I think in some ways it's more important inside your own community to call it out as well.
Sorry folks, because of the light, I just have to switch on a filter and move my place. So there are a number of questions in the queue around who gets to name, identify, define, legislate anti-Semitism. So I wanted to first start with you, Ken. Who gets to legislate anti-Semitism and who gets to define anti-Semitism? Is it the IHRA? Is it Jews? Is it, you know, Mike Pompeo? Who is it?
Well, I don't think Jews could agree on any, you know, definition. So when you talk about the Jews defining it, you know, which group of Jews? But look, I mean, and I could, if you want, I could spend a couple of minutes going into the background of the IRA thing to set that up, if you like. Okay. So basically what happened there was that the Second Intifada attacks on Jews in Europe, there was a group that was tasked with collecting data on it, called the EUMC. And the problem they had two problems. One is that there was no sort of markers for data collectors of what to include and what to exclude in different countries. And the second is they were faced with the challenge of what do you do when a Jew is attacked as a stand-in for an Israeli. So what they did is they said, well, here's a definition about anti-Semitism. It's a list of stereotypes, which to me was reflective of what anti-Semitism was as opposed to its defining characteristics. But it was, really was a subterfuge to say, well, if a Jew was attacked on the streets of Paris as a stand-in for an Israeli and the actor had those views about the stereotypes about Israelis and transferred them back to the Jew in Paris, it's anti-Semitism, but if they were set at Israeli policy, it wasn't. And that made no more sense to me than somebody in the 50s being strung up on a tree in the, you know, lynched in the South because somebody thought blacks were shiftless and lazy. That's racism, but upset with the Civil Rights Act or a speech of Martin Luther King, that's not. So it was a effort to try to create some sort of a measure over time and over borders to get a snapshot of what anti-Semitism was. And it was also important to include some examples about Israel because we saw a correlation, I'm not saying causation by any means, but a correlation between increases in anti-Zionist and critical things about Israel in the context usually of wars with almost overlapping the same graph of attacks on people. So it was to get a measure, it was not to classify anybody as an anti-Semite. It was actually also, there was debates in Europe about, remember that there was a gentleman who was kidnapped and held for ransom and ultimately killed in France because everybody thought Jews were rich. So was that anti-Semitism? Was it not? It was a clear desire to create a standard that said if somebody is attacked because they're seen as Jewish or linked with Jews, that's should be counted and to give some clarity on that. It was never to create a standard definition that would be applied writ large, places like the campus and other places. And the concern for me is that when we allow the government to define which political speech should be pushed down, suppressed, even perhaps criminalized in certain circumstances, that's a danger. It's always going to be the speech that the government doesn't like. So I don't think it's an appropriate thing for any governmental agency, whether it's the executive order or what Pompeo was saying, to define anti-Semitism in that context and say that speech is out of bounds any more than if it would, in a parallel situation, decide opposition to Confederate statues being removed or opposition to affirmative action ought to be able to create a definition of what is racism that was governmentally endorsed.
And can you, either of you actually, just name the acronym IHRA? What does that stand for those who don't know?
Sure. The International Holocaust Remembrance Association. So it was a group that, the working definition started with the EUMC, as I said, and then the EUMC got absorbed into the Fundamental Rights Agency of the EU. And the definition was under some pressure by opponents and others for a long time. And then the IHRA, particularly Mark Weitzman from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, but others decided to institutionalize it there and then promote it for governments to adopt.
Great. I would echo what Ken said, that I don't think that we're going to come to a universally agreed upon definition of anti-Semitism. Again, I'm not sure that we have one that everybody agrees on about racism or sexism or anything else. I think it would, there's obviously a lot of people with a lot of different opinions, and it makes sense to have conversations about anti-Semitism like we do about everything else, and to be able to teach some of the history. The issue, as Ken said, is he's been very just a really important voice saying, and I think you testified to Congress, if I remember correctly, saying that mm-hmm. you wrote that definition and you didn't mean for there to be legislation around it. And I'll say that a lot of times when people talk about this definition, they talk about it as one coherent thing. And you know, everybody who hasn't read it can Google and find it pretty easily, but there's a very short definition, which is very concise, and I don't have it memorized, but you can find it, but it's very concise. And then there's a number of examples, and most of the examples are what most people would call very clear examples of anti-Semitism, Holocaust denial, et cetera. And there's really two, when we're arguing about the IHRA definition, we're really arguing about just a couple of the examples. And those are the examples that are specifically about Israel and Zionism. So to argue that the establishment of the state of Israel was a racist endeavor, for example. Again, like we get into the weeds of what does it mean to argue that that was a racist endeavor and what does it mean to be anti-Zionist? So just to take an example from another world, I mean, my kids as far back as second grade already understood that there was a genocide of Native Americans in order to form the United States. And that's a conversation that they had in class. Now, I don't know that anybody is arguing that every single person who is not indigenous to this land should leave, but it's a fair conversation for whether you're in second grade or college or anywhere else to have in a history class to talk about what happened. Now, I just wanna be clear. I am not comparing the establishment of the United States to the establishment of Israel. I'm not saying there was a genocide. I'm just taking a different historical example that one can have a real conversation on a counterfactual. What if that hadn't happened? Was that the right thing? Was it a wrong thing? That's different. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're arguing that everybody who is currently living in Israel, that all 6 million Jews who are citizens of Israel, you know, out of the 8 million citizens or so in the country, should get on a boat and go somewhere else. That would be anti-Semitic to say, let's create a refugee crisis by actually expelling all the Jews from Israel. So the difference is arguing about a historical issue versus making an argument that potentially would lead to a massive refugee crisis and death. So that's one of the pieces. And then the other question is about a double standard. That's language that gets thrown around a lot, that there's a double standard. And so usually a double standard would really mean that you're holding Israel to a standard that you're not holding other countries. Now, usually when people talk about occupation or about Israel's human rights abuses, we're talking about specific human rights law. So there's very specific laws about occupation and relationship to an occupied population, including things like not moving civilians into occupied territory. And so generally when we're talking about that situation, we're holding Israel to the same standard as other countries. But it's not like there's a rule about occupation that only applies to Israel and didn't apply to the US, the Allied occupation of Germany, for example. The same laws, this is what applies. So often when people use the language of double standard, they don't really mean that Israel is held to different international human rights standards than other countries. What they mean is there's more of a focus on Israel than on other countries. And there's a lot of reasons for that. That is true. It is definitely true that there's more of a focus on Israel than on other countries. There is for sure anti-Semitism mixed in there. There's also the fact that Israel is just more in the center of people's universe than other countries, that it's a holy place for three religions, and it's a place that people have visited, and it's just much more, say, accessible, at least in people's minds, but also physically accessible than maybe other countries. There's fewer people who have traveled to Iran or places like that. And it's also true that some of this is a reaction because there's a very strong, visible pro-Israel presence in the United States. Now, again, there's a very strong pro-Gulf states or pro-China presence, but it's less visible. And so it's some of the reaction is, it's a reaction to that. And of course, Israel is the largest recipient of US aid, not kind of counting the countries that we've invaded. And so there's a lot of reasons that Israel has become the center of so much activism, as well as once something is the hot topic, then it's a hot topic. So I think about when I was in college in the late 90s, it was about Tibet. And I don't know anybody who I went to college with who actually had spent time in Tibet or had a personal relationship to it, but that was the issue. Now, you know, Tibet is still not free, but the activism has moved on. And so that's, you know, sometimes that's the way it goes. And the last thing I would say is that human rights, running a human rights organization, people say to us, well, why do you only focus on the US, Canada, and Israel and the occupied territories? And for us, our answer is, well, we live in the United States and Canada. We're a binational organization. And as Jews, we have a deep relationship to Israel. And when you look at the rest of the human rights field, there's not a single human rights organization, certainly that I know of, that works in every single country. Many of them work in a lot of countries, but ultimately you choose. And so human rights is always choosing, well, we're gonna work on this issue and not that issue. The last thing that I'll say is that sometimes those who are making that argument and saying, well, why aren't we working on Syria or the Rohingya, I mean, there are Jewish organizations who are, sometimes that's, it's just used as an attack line. It's not coming from people who are actually devoting their time to working on those issues. It's just using that as a tool for attacking those who are working on Israel. And so the real concern about those two particular examples is that it can very easily, and already is being used, to clamp down on campus activism in particular, though it could show up in other places. So for example, if you have a campus student group that is, you know, like SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, that is only working on Palestine, then you can say, well, unless you're also gonna work on the Rohingya and on the situation in Syria and the Uyghurs and, you know, name 1,000 other human rights concerns, and that's using a double standard. And, you know, whereas if there were a group called the campus something for the Uyghurs, I don't think that anybody would say to them, well, that's a double standard on China. Why aren't you also working on the Rohingya?
And if I could add to that, some of those are, you know, precise points. One, you know, it's a question to me of misuse of the definition to weaponize it in the way that Jill was saying, in the way that it was never intended. And just to give you a little bit more background on those two bullet points. Okay, the one about double standard was there, the thinking was, okay, would Canada, if it was lobbing bombs into the United States, would anybody expect the United States as a democratic society to just say, okay, you know, we're not gonna do anything about it, when Israel was getting, you know, rockets coming in from Gaza? So that was the type of double standard that was the behind the process. You know, when I was protesting for Soviet Jews, nobody was saying, well, why aren't you doing Tibet? And as I put in my, you know, book, if you look back in the history of, you know, the opposition to Jim Crow, there were segregationists that were talking about the Communist Party in the U.S. saying, well, why aren't you talking about human rights abuses in the Soviet Union? They weren't. That was a fair excuse, but didn't make them wrong about civil rights in the United States. So I think that's one context. The other thing in terms of the anti-Zionism aspect, again, it was for the purpose of taking temperature. And you got to remember, looking back in time, so let me give you a little bit of history. I remember well, you know, the years between 75 and 91, when the United Nations equated Zionism with racism as a de facto, this is law. And so what happened? You had people that were making the assumption that if you're a Jew, you're therefore a Zionist. If you're Zionist, therefore you're a racist, and therefore you shouldn't be allowed to have Jewish organizations. It happened in some places in the UK. So there was a correlation between that and experiences of anti-Semitic discrimination for sure. Then the World Conference Against Racism in Durban in 2001 was in many ways an attempt to rekindle that. And there were, you know, vile anti-Semitic statements there. So that was the sort of precursor to not include, when you're trying to take the temperature, some measure of, you know, the anti-Zionist discourse that was reflective of 3379 would have been a mistake, because there was a correlation with what we were seeing. To say, though, as the flip side of the Zionism equals racism always, to say that anti-Zionism is always anti-Semitism, which is what Kushner said, and, you know, what Pompeo is saying, again, goes into the same black and white areas, and it's going to promote discrimination against pro-Palestinian activists and Palestinians the same way that the Zionism equals racism, you know, quota in law did that against Jews.
Okay. So continue with both of you have mentioned activism, legislation, and all that. Just to name an elephant that's been in the Jewish sphere for, I don't know, about 5 years now, maybe more. So I'm somebody who is Black and Jewish, and I unequivocally say that Black Lives Matter. And so there was a platform put out by the Movement for Black Lives that has since changed and taken out language of around Israel. However, the same rhetoric is still being circulated through Jewish circles. So where do you see the line between the rhetoric that people haven't checked in on and the reality?
So speaking specifically about that, first of all, we should all be able to say unequivocally that Black Lives Matter. I mean, that's just a basic statement of humanity, and we need to say it. And as Jews, I mean, the very first thing that we learn about human beings is that we're created B'Tselem Elohim, in the image of God, which means that any injury that's done to a human being is an injury that's to God. And so we should say that absolutely unequivocally. And the platform was 200 pages long. I don't know, at least. I don't know how many people read the whole thing, and I'm guessing that most people who did, right, for sure, that would find something to disagree with. I mean, it just covered about 1,000 different areas. So the particular area around Israel, the two words that came up that sparked a lot of the drama were apartheid and genocide. Now, you know, I don't think that Israel is not carrying out a genocide of Palestinians according to any international human rights definition. In terms of apartheid, there's an argument certainly that what's happening in the West Bank meets that international definition. The Israeli human rights lawyer, Michal Sfar, just put out a very comprehensive legal paper on that, but what's happening inside of the internationally recognized borders of the state of Israel is not. So I think that we can have a real argument based on human rights, on international human rights definitions of those two words, and that we can disagree vehemently to that, and specifically to the language of apartheid, which of course is a community that has, the language of genocide in particular, you know, as in a community that's experienced a genocide in historic memory, that obviously is very triggering for us. And, but that doesn't mean that the entire movement is anti-Semitic, and I'd say that too much of the conversation has been refocusing, you know, like 99% or more, maybe, you know, point something something percent of the people who are in the streets for Black Lives Matter are there to protest police brutality, which is killing people, which is killing Black and brown people in this country. And that's why people are on the street. And the extreme focus on the Israel positions within this platform, which are not, you know, most of the reason that people are on the street, just is a distraction from that very urgent need to stop police from killing Black and brown people.
So Rabbi Jacobs, should people who are not Jewish, who inhabit other identities, be required to have a stance on Israel in order to, I don't know, get Jewish support?
I don't think anybody needs to have a stance on anything. I mean, I don't really, ask people for their stance on any number of issues that we might work on. But I'll say, more broadly, when we talk about coalition work, that we are often, the very nature of coalition work is that sometimes you're working on one issue with people with whom you disagree even vehemently on other issues. And my example is that Truaz worked, for example, with the Catholic Church on issues of solitary confinement. We worked with many religious groups on issues of torture and incarceration. And in many cases, we would, not only would we have strong disagreements around LGBTQ issues and reproductive rights, but actually some of the positions that some of those religious institutions are taking are actively harmful to people in our community, I would say also in their community. And so, but the nature of coalition work is that you're working on X and you're not working on Y, and that's the only way that things can happen. And we know that the right has learned this lesson really well, because otherwise we wouldn't have a situation where we have white evangelicals and, say, some Wall Street types, kind of classic Republicans, who are all white nationalists, right? Who were all able to support a single president, because they realized that they were able to put aside some other differences in order to push forward their agenda. That there were plenty of people who said, you know what, we might not like his racism and his language, but he's going to push forward a tax bill that we're happy with. Now, I'm not saying that's justified, but I am saying that that is effective. And so sometimes on the left, we tend to tear each other apart by having litmus tests and insisting on agreement on everything. But the way that we move our issues forward is by working with groups with whom we don't always agree on everything.
And if I could add to that with just a little bit of a different view, if you look internally in the Jewish community about where that divide is taking a position, I'm really, you know, worried about that in a lot of ways. And one of the things that I put in my book was quoting one of the founders of Open Hillel, who had a very strong perception that she said, look, you know, around Shabbat dinner at a Hillel house, you can get people that are non-observant, Chabad, Orthodox, Reform, everybody could break bread. It's impossible to do over Israel, which is deeply troubling. There's a Stanford study that suggests that when Jewish students come to a campus that, and most campuses aren't activated about Israel, but some are, and when they are in those places, they feel a push to declare at the onset, am I on the pro-Palestinian side or am I on the pro-Israel side? And this sort of stark thing is what it's doing is it's turning Jewish students away from Jewish life. So to the extent that outside forces continue the attempt to make this a black and white, good and bad, there's no nuance here, you have to stake your identity and push for one side or the other, we're not harming not only the greater world and the academy, I think we're also harming the Jewish community.
Great. So Ken, there's this one question from Andrea Damsky. Hopefully I'm getting that right. So she says, in my city, members of the Arab community are demanding that anti-Semitism be redefined to include them, with the reasoning that they are Semitic peoples too. So she's asking for your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's an old and ridiculous thing. I mean, Semites isn't about people. If you look at the term, it's about a group of languages. Anti-Semitism as a term was defined by a German who was promoting it, named Wilhelm Marr, in the 1870s. It had nothing to do with Arabs. It had only to do with Jews. And I think when you try to, homogenize it that way, it's a challenge. I think Islamophobia is a real deal. And I think people ought to be concerned about it. And, certainly we've had from Trump's, Muslim ban to look at hate crimes, look at all different sorts of things. That's a real thing. To call it something else, I think, does a disservice. The same type of thing where, Jill was alluding to in terms of genocide or people using the term Holocaust to refer to every other type of horror in human history. I'm not saying that the Holocaust is worse by any means, but I think when you try to do things, I know people were talking about the slave trade as the Black Holocaust. It takes away from the slave trade, and I don't know how you compare those things, right? One was more over time and had more countries involved. One was a shorter period, but was more modern. So when people try to take these horrible things that have happened and say, let's twist the meaning for some other political purpose, I think it doesn't do them any good and it doesn't do the world any good.
I totally agree with that. And I'll also add that anti-Semitism has always, well, at least since the 19th century when Marx came up with this term, that has always meant prejudice against Jews. And so it doesn't make sense to try to change that meaning now in a way that often minimizes prejudice against Jews. First of all, and there are, you can talk about Islamophobia, you can talk about anti-Arab bias. And the other piece that I'll add is that I've seen this language come up more and more in the last few years. This is like something I learned about in history class, but is not, unfortunately, it's not history, that the language that, well, the current today's Ashkenazi Jews in particular are just descended from Khazar converts, which is an old anti-Semitic, I don't want to say theory as though it's true, but an old anti-Semitic conspiracy, that today's Jews are not real Jews. And that is very often used against the Jewish community. And sometimes the language is, well, Jews aren't Semites, Arabs are Semites, and today's Jews aren't real Jews. And that is just, you know, that's just a conspiracy that just needs to be shut down. And so trying to apply anti-Semitism in places where it shouldn't apply is one of the tools of that.
Yeah, and that's one thing that's easy on the right and the left, the Khazar story.
Yeah, I will also say I hear that a lot from many, many people, especially like Jewish adjacent communities, is as far as I'll go. So there is, there are lots of questions around Israeli policies, Israeli actions, and the West Bank. Let's see, this one is from Jason Berkovich. Can you elaborate on why you think the West Bank qualifies as an apartheid state and why that is Israel's fault? It seems like the Palestinians have their own leadership, which has refused to hold elections, and their own security forces, which work to maintain their power. Jill?
Yeah, so I'm not going to go into all the details. You should Google the article that was written by Michael Sfar, the legal paper. But in short, we're talking about Area C of the West Bank, which is not about the whole West Bank. I wasn't specific before, but Area C, which is fully under Israeli control. And that's the places where, that's the part where Israeli settlements are. And in those areas, which are not at all, as I said, under PA control, there's two different sets of laws happening. So Israelis living there basically take their Israeli law into the West Bank, and they're living under Israeli civil law, even though they're in occupied territory, whereas the Palestinians are living under occupation, under military law. So that's the top line definition is that there's two different legal systems for two people who might be living, just within a few meters even of each other.
And if I could add to that, I mean, getting back to the larger frame of how people look at things and how they think about things when hatred and identity is involved, we try to push things into, again, the black and white. So is it apartheid, or is it not at all like apartheid? And in most ways, things are more complex. It has some aspects that resemble apartheid, and it has some aspects that are quite different. Same type of thing, and this I go into in the book too, the claim that Israel is settler colonial state. And there are some ways that it is, and it acted that way out of that period in colonialism. And there are some things that are entirely unique. I quote Judea Pearl, the father of Daniel Pearl, the journalist who was assassinated, talking about, say, another settler colonial state where people are speaking the language that was spoken there thousands of years ago, where they don't come and name new cities, New Berlin and New Warsaw, by the names in biblical time and so forth. So, I think the important thing is to resist the temptation to label it this way or label it that way, but to really crave the complexities.
There are still more questions about the IHRA. But here, there are also some questions around how do we actually combat anti-Semitism? How do we combat how anti-Zionism sometimes labels anti-Semitism or folds it in? Let's start with you, Jill.
All right. Well, I wish I had the perfect formula for combating anti-Semitism. I have to say that right after the Pittsburgh killings, I was talking to a reporter, a non-Jewish reporter, who said to me something like, well, I thought the anti-Semitism went away after the Holocaust, and now it seems like it's back, and do you think that we can get rid of it again? And I just, you know, obviously this was somebody who wasn't living in that context. I said, you know, for the Jewish community, we've never thought that it's disappeared, and I don't think that we're really going to be able to get rid of it in the next few years, since we haven't for a couple thousand years. But so that said, you know, I don't know the perfect way to get rid of racism or sexism or homophobia either, but I do know that it is important to understand the history, to learn about it, not to expect that everyone around us has already done their dissertation in anti-Semitism, but to understand that we're all in a process, somewhere along that process. And then also a key piece is having relationships with other communities. When we talk about equal marriage in the United States, a lot of the analysis said that what really shifted is at a certain point, there were very few people who could say that they didn't have a relative or a friend or an acquaintance or somebody who was LGBTQ, and that really shifted when it became not about some other people who we don't know, but about my sister or my cousin or my neighbor. And so also it's really important in the Jewish community to have those relationships. And I say that as somebody who runs a Jewish human rights organization that is in the mix and partnering with organizations run by with secular organizations or other interfaith organizations run by people who are not Jewish all the time. And often we have to have difficult conversations about anti-Semitism. It'll come up and we'll talk about it. And also people know to ask us questions. And the same thing happens in reverse, that we're also learning all the time about other communities. And that's really crucial, that if we have those kinds of long-term relationships, and if other communities know that we're going to show up for them, they're also going to show up for us. It's not, you know, it's not going to go away in the next few years, but I do believe that in that as the long-term way to bring about change.
And I would echo that. I think it's important to work through organizations, you know, like Jill's, and there are many others too, grassroots groups in different parts of the country, human rights groups that are open to having discussions about anti-Semitism, and that should be part of their work. And people should, you know, support those groups. I think there are a couple other things too. I agree with Jill, there's no magic bullet in this, but one is, I think inside the Jewish community, we have to be consistent. One of the things that was most troubling to me about the executive order that Trump signed, aside from all the issues around IRA and how that was going to be used on the campus, is here you had a president that we know was, even though it may not have been its intent, was stoking anti-Semitism by stoking the us versus them. Mexicans are rapists. Muslims, you know, are dangerous and so forth. And people there instinctively knew that the rise of anti-Semitism was associated with the license to see in us versus them and vilified to them. Yet they came and not a word was spoken about what the president was doing on a daily basis. You know, Dershowitz was saying this is the best thing that happened to the Jewish community in 2000 years that he signed the executive order. So I think we have to be very clear about what anti-Semitism is and not give people a free ride, even though we may agree with their position on Israel. I think another thing that's really important, and again, it's thinking with a little bit larger lens, is I think the capacity to combat anti-Semitism is directly tied to the strength of democratic institutions. If you look historically, I think you can make that case. I worry about our democratic institutions under stress here, the attack on the press, the attack on the judiciary. If we're fighting for the strength of our democracy, that'll make it easier to combat anti-Semitism. And then finally, one of the things that I think anybody who has a connection with a university can do is to encourage the teaching about anti-Semitism. There are very few courses. Some of them are that are there are sort of, I think, polemical in some way. But I think it's important to get an interdisciplinary understanding of anti-Semitism, not just as a, you know, as a sentence or two in a course on racism, or as we're only talking about the Holocaust, but to talking about anti-Semitism as a serious subject in its own right. I think that's a good window into the larger question about hatred. And the more we encourage that type of thinking, I think the better off we'll be.
Are there any messages that you all have for those of us who experience both anti-Semitism and anti-Blackness in particular?
I feel like we should throw that question to you, Jared.
Yeah. I guess with that, I would say come to one of... Interesting spot being the moderator. usually I would say that, you know, for somebody like myself, I can't necessarily separate the two all the time, because usually when somebody's attacking my Jewishness, they're also attacking my Blackness, right? And therefore, as we combat anti-Semitism, we have to be mindful that we are not just talking about it being solely like anti other white ethnic groups, which Jews are not like a white ethnic group, because we are a multiracial group of humans on this planet. So just one pivot, and I think this may take us to the end. So this is another elephant in the room. BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions against Israel. What is its effectiveness? Does it have any legs to stand on? When it comes to the treatment of Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank, what can be done about BDS, and what can be understood? So I'll start with Rabbi Jacobs.
I will get to that, but I wanted to just go back to something that you just said that I think is really important that I wanted to highlight, that it's very hard to put Jews in a box, and everybody would like to. And that's in the United States, I think there's a desire to put Jews into the box of religion, right? Like the same, to say, well, there's Christianity and there's Judaism, right? And so Judaism is just about religious things, which is why it then doesn't make sense to anybody, when you find out that there's Jews who are atheists but consider themselves Jewish, which makes total sense to any Jew, but doesn't necessarily make sense to, right? You can't say I'm Christian, but I don't believe that Jesus Christ is the Lord and Savior. That doesn't make any sense. And so, Jews have always thought of ourselves, and we use the word right? A people, a tribe, a group, right? We have, of course, rituals, and we have a land, and we have languages, and we have just lots of traditions, right? We can go on and on with the list, but it doesn't fit neatly into a box as an ethnicity or a religion, or certainly not a color, or right, or any of those other boxes that one might try to create. So that is really important. It's also why it's very hard for many people to understand anti-Semitism. So BDS, so boycotts are a protected right of free speech that's been established in law. And so it's a different question whether BDS should somehow be made illegal, which it should not, in my opinion, and whether it's something that one chooses to support. So Trua and J Street together actually have filed a number of amicus briefs in a few different cases where different states, Texas and Georgia and Arkansas, have passed laws that have prevented people who either individual contractors, so it could be an individual or a company, who support boycotting Israel, or in some cases Israel or the territories it can control. So that includes the West Bank, which I'll point out that many Israelis living in Israel do boycott, from getting certain government jobs. And so the argument that we've made, you can find our amicus brief, it's online in a few places, certainly on our website, is look, we as organizations don't participate in the BDS movement. And we also believe that free speech includes the right of people to speech that we might not agree with. That's a basic principle of free speech. And also that when the government tries to clamp down on free speech, it's dangerous for everybody, you know, often actually, especially Jews. One of my favorite examples is before World War I, when it suddenly became, you know, certain kinds of speech became illegal, that the Postmaster General tried to take away the media mailing status of the Forward, because they were publishing anti-war op-eds, and the Forward ended up, they would have gone broke because they couldn't afford first-class postage. And so they ended up censoring themselves. You know, it's a much longer, complicated story, but basically ended up censoring themselves, which is, right, that's dangerous. So, you know, boycotts, one can agree with the BDS movement, with the principles and aims of the BDS movement, with the strategies. There's lots of conversation we can have about that, but it is protected free speech. And it is also, it's also nonviolent. And I'll also add that, you know, as a rabbi working in the Jewish community, that I think that the focus on trying to pass these kinds of laws, sometimes it's Jewish communal institutions, sometimes it's Christian institutions trying to pass these laws, and on fighting BDS is terrible for our community, both because it saps all sorts of resources that could be going to something that is more productive and positive and has a real impact on our community, whether it's education or other kinds of things. And also because it's just generating a backlash. So if you're gonna try to outlaw BDS, of course, then people are more interested in it. And it generates more of a backlash against Israel. So if the goal is to somehow protect Israel, then these kinds of campaigns don't even achieve that goal, as well as, of course, the fact that they're clamping down on free speech and even on, you know, more generally on speech that's critical of Israel and occupation.
Yeah, and I would fully endorse everything that Jill said. I'm really worried when we're in a position where the government tries to pass legislation that takes certain speech that it disagrees with, and says the government, is harming people who may agree with that position. I think the idea of dissent, the idea of free speech is important. That said, you know, about BDS personally, I disagree with it. I think it empowers the extremes on both sides. But I think people are creating too big an image of its effect. When I go and speak about the campus, and I go in front of a Jewish audience that may tend to the right, and I ask people for a show of hands, you know, since the first divestment petition hit the college campus in 2002, how many colleges have divested from Israel? The answer is zero. There have been a couple, you know, student resolutions passed, but no divestment. So it has a minimal impact on that level. About, you know, boycotting Golan wines or things from the West Bank doesn't bother me too much, although I dislike the idea of BDS in principle. It's different, by the way, than the Arab boycott, which was a problem years ago, and some people are trying to marry the two. What does trouble me the most is the whole idea of the academic boycott. To me, the academy is a prized place. It's been important for everybody, including Jewish students. And when you say that because somebody is an Israeli or associated with an Israeli academic institution, their ideas should be tossed out and looked at differently as an abrogation of everything that we should be doing. So there's one part of BDS that really gets under my craw. That's that. I think that's horrible.
And so we have come to the end of our journey here. So I just want to ask both of you for just a very short closing remark, even though we just had a very complex discussion. We'll start with Rabbi Jacobs.
Thanks. We've said a lot. I will just say that anti-Semitism is a complex issue. I definitely encourage people to read about it, to read about the history, and to talk about it with folks, and also to maybe notice when it feels like it's coming up as in a way that is only against one side or the other. You know, very often it's about, a lot of the focus is about anti-Semitism on the left, on those who are critical of Israel. So just to notice that, and also whatever side, I know there's 250 people on this call, so I'm not gonna assume where anybody sits politically, but especially to notice for yourself, if it feels like you're focusing on where it's coming up on the other political side, because of course we always have to take care of our own houses as well.
Yeah, I would fully agree with that. Consistent principles are important. So, and having the imagination to think about if you were in a different, you know, box and how you would feel about that is important, rather than trying to weaponize and feeling good about a fight, to think about more critical thinking and to realize that sometimes when you feel good about something because you're fighting a battle against somebody that you perceive has a different interest in you, what feels good frequently does not do good, it frequently does harm. So I would encourage people to have a sort of larger frame of thinking. And I also want to say, I see there are like 67 questions we didn't get to. So if anybody wants to email me when you guys send out a reminder, you could certainly encourage people, or you can find me at kstern at bar.edu. I'm happy to continue a conversation via email.
Ditto. And I'll say that I didn't even try to read the Q&A or the chat because I can't listen and read. So if we didn't get to your question, I didn't read it. I was just depending on what Jared asked us. So also happy to be in touch.
Great. So right now I'll kick it back to Karen Shapiro from Partners for Progressive Israel.
There. Thank you, Jared. Thank you, Jill, and thank you, Ken. I think one of the ways to combat anti-Semitism is to have conversations like this. You've given us much to think about and much more to further discuss. And certainly here at Partners for Progressive Israel, we will continue this discussion. Thanks to all of you who have joined us here today, and also thank you to the staff of Partners for Progressive Israel for their work in making this discussion happen. We hope all of you have enjoyed this webinar and have gotten something out of it. We are glad to bring programs like this to you for free. If you want to learn more about our upcoming program, please visit our website at progressiveisrael.org. And while you are there, make a contribution. That is what enables us to bring programs like this to you at no cost. If there are people you know who couldn't join us, this has been recorded and will be available on both Facebook and on our website in a few days, this conversation. Thank you all very much. I greatly appreciate everyone here, and stay safe and healthy and be well. Bye.